everyone, to the inaugural episode of 2025. I'm interviewing my dear friend, Elijah B. Wilder, who among many things is an author, he's a philosopher, he's a man about town, and in general, just a really, really funny human being who uses puns a lot. And I kind of think that's what captured my fancy around our friendship, is that Elijah absolutely loves dad jokes. And you know what? I do too. So we've become fast friends. This episode is a sweet one. And Elijah shares a story from childhood where, as a kiddo, he got to witness something rather beautiful, something rather unexpected, and something that helped him to know that even goldfish contain miracles. We also talk about Kantian aesthetics in this one, and not really all that much. The one philosophical idea that caught my fancy was the way the Japanese treat shadows. And there's a very famous book around this that I'm hopefully going to read soon, In Praise of Shadows. And it's by Junichiro Tanizaki. Please forgive me if that name is pronounced incorrectly. This book was published in 1933 and contrasts the Japanese love of shadows and dim lighting with the Western ideals of brightness. And the author kind of is suggesting that shadows, dimming the lights in rooms, those things can be very powerful. They're very subtle, but in that subtlety is incredible power. And I was thinking about this in reference to the presidential regime that's coming in so very soon. I think a lot of people are anticipating a lot of darkness, a lot of intensity, a lot of stress, a lot of maybe being scared. And I was thinking of shadows and how beautiful they are, how soft, but also how shadows can very strongly define the shape of an object in a room if you have the correct lighting. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, within these spaces, within these places, not only is there great beauty in these dim rooms when you observe these shadows, but also there's so much potential. And I think people take shadows for granted. In dim light, at least I believe, a lot can be accomplished. A lot can be seen. A lot can be kind of fomented and like stirred up and like a great big pot of soup worked on and nobody's any the wiser. And so while I am sort of dreading what's coming later this month, I also realize that this could be a time for great opportunity, for great change, for great growth, for great magic to happen in the shadows where nobody's looking. And so, with that sentiment in mind, let's get to my conversation with Elijah B. Wilder.
I've always loved psychopomps. Like, the Grim Reaper is probably the most commonly recognized in America psychopomp. And I was trying to figure out why I'm so obsessed with psychopomps. And Carl Jung would be so happy that it goes back to my childhood.
Okay, so the first question I ask everybody, and it's proved to be a stumper for some people, is how do you self-describe? If you had to go to a party or a conference, you had to introduce yourself to people, how would you do that?
What kind of party?
Oh, gosh. Let's say, since 'tis the season, let's say like it's a New Year's Eve party.
Okay. In what sort of company? Like friends?
Oh, friends. Absolutely friends. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'll pretend I have those. I would say I'm a writer.
I know. And you have, well, you just had your first book come out. And I mean, have you thought of yourself as a writer ever since you were a kid? Or is this something that's kind of evolved over time, I guess?
I did think of myself as a writer ever since I was a kid, but I wouldn't have had the gumption. I'll say gumption instead of what I was actually about to say. The gumption to say I am a writer until I actually got hired to do a thing or published a thing, pretty much, because the imposter syndrome affects many fields, but definitely writers also.
Oh, yeah. I mean, talk about, you know, who are, it's almost like, well, in any vocation, you can say this, you measure yourself against others. But I mean, in writing, you have these giants, right? These giants like Dickens, or I mean, you name anyone, whatever kind of genre you like, there's like a few titans or giants who everybody kind of adores and worships. And of course, oh my God, imposter syndrome is crazy. But I do remember as a kid doing some writing, feeling a little bit of pressure. Mine kind of was Ella Montgomery, Anne of Green Gables, who I measured myself against. And just her lyrical way of describing Prince Edward Island and what the islands were like and just the adventures that were happening. I just thought, I'm never going to be able to do this.
It's a special book, or a special series of books, I should say.
Yeah. Did you have any titans or favorites when you were a kid?
As a kid, not so much. As a kid, I didn't get really into reading until I was older, but as like a kid, when you were probably reading Anne of Green Gables, because you were much more literate than I was watching Wishbone and feeling literate by proxy because a Jack Russell Terrier was explaining the plot of great novels to me. And so like through a lot of my undergraduate education, even people thought I was much better read than I was because I'd seen every episode of Wishbone like 5 times. And I was like, yeah, I know all the themes of Wuthering Heights. I don't think they actually did an episode of Wishbone about Wuthering Heights. That would have been weird, but you know what I mean.
I feel like we need to bring that book, like Wishbone talking about the great books. That could totally be like a thing.
There are books. That's the great part about Wishbone. It's a TV show about books that they then novelized into books about a TV show about books.
Oh, you're kidding.
It's
okay.
So layers.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a deeper dive. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's amazing. Apparently, I'm like a day late and a dollar short. But first of all, I have to tell you that I love that this was like one of your exposures to literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just didn't really read much as a kid. And my dad read me 2 books. Redwall by Brian Jakes. And that was fantastic. And I still love that book. And The Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I thought Turkish Delight was something different than it actually was. And I was very disappointed, like everyone who read that book and had Turkish Delight for the first time. But later, I would say that my Titan ended up becoming like Terry Pratchett and Peter S. Beagle became my Titans. Of just like, okay, maybe this book is fine. It's legible, I suppose, in some rudimentary sense. And there's maybe 1 or 2 interesting or funny things happening. But I'm no Terry Pratchett and I'm no Peter S. Beagle. So why bother waking up in the morning, you know?
Also, I think you went to graduate school. You're a philosopher. Is that, I think I'm right about that. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tragically, yeah.
Tragically. What, let's say, if you had to pick 1 or 2 philosophies that really speak to you, what would you choose?
Golly gosh. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to have 1 answer that seems kind of neat, maybe, and then 1 answer that's super nerdy. And my super nerdy answer is Kantian aesthetics. And you know what? I don't want to talk about it. I'm not ready. I only got my PhD like 1 year ago, and I haven't healed from the trauma. And so I'm just going to move on to the thing that's maybe a little bit cooler.
Well, exciting. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Would be the Japanese aesthetic handling of shadows and the beauty's not quite the right word, profundity of shadows, I would say would be a good translation. The most famous work on this is by Junichiro Tanizaki called In Praise of Shadows, and it's been translated. And so you can read it. It's pretty short, but it's basically comparing traditional Japanese aesthetics, especially in design and in the home, to conventional Western modern aesthetics, especially in terms of light and darkness, and how in Western aesthetics, everything has to have a bright light shown on it, and things need to be shiny and new. And then in the traditional Japanese aesthetic, there's a certain elegance and profundity and beauty to shadows and what isn't shown and what you don't see. And I try to incorporate that into I have a really severe astigmatism and sensory processing issues. And so I'm really sensitive to light, which is why it's so dark in here. And I just have string lights. So it's only partially because I'm whimsical. It's also part practicality. But I do try to force myself to incorporate that idea of things being more profound when you can't see them all the way into my writing.
Especially
as a self-regulation of the fact that I overwrite. Like, I've never once had the issue in my entire life of something I wrote being too short, ever.
I am just completely enthralled with this idea of shadows. You know, you first brought it up and said it, and I immediately went to the Western Carl Jung, the shadow, mm-hmm. This thing that we carry inside of all of us. And I guess, you could still go there through this Japanese method of appreciating and valuing, what's shaded or what's in the dark, and that mm-hmm. not everything has to be seen, that it's okay to have a little mystery in this life. It's okay but people are really scared of things they cannot see.
Yeah. Like the big one, the D word, death. I should specify when I say the D word. Oh,
yes, that's a true story. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying. I was like, I didn't know it was going to death, but I was thinking the delicacy, dandelion, dill pickle. And then I realized, no, it's none of those.
That's, if my mom listens to this, then I know where her head is going to go. And so yes. I just wanted to clarify, I mean death and not dill pickles.
There we go.
Which is what so many of us would have assumed it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of beauty in not knowing some things because there's mystery in that. And I'm making a general statement here, but a lot of people, a lot of friends, a lot of just acquaintances, people in the theological world, people want to illuminate everything and excavate everything and bring everything out into the light. And for me, the excitement, where we should be paying attention or maybe just glancing at something side-eyed, is the things that live in the dark, because that's where all the richness comes from. You can think about it as like soil. There's so much going on under our feet. We don't think about it. Mm-hmm. And it's all happening in the dark.
And it's this odd sort of thing where on the one hand, people want everything to be illuminated and they're not okay with not knowing things. And then, in a sense, it's like thinking about it in terms of religious experience or your experience of the spiritual or whatever you want to call it. People tend to think of like scientific discovery as being something that's opposed to spirituality, because they have this idea that any religion is based entirely on explanations. Supernatural explanations for things that you can't explain scientifically. And so those two things are mutually exclusive. But to me, knowing how something works in a scientific sort of way doesn't make it seem less profound or magical to me in a way. If that makes sense. So it's like this weird balancing act between like, I like not knowing things and I don't need to know everything in the world. But at the same time, knowing things doesn't necessarily take away from the meaning. Sometimes it adds to it. And it's just, you gotta have them both, I guess. If only there was some concept that someone came up with of maybe like a circle and one side was light and one side was dark and the dark side had a little bit of the light and the light side had a little bit of the dark in it. We could just like, I don't know what we would call it.
I don't know. I mean, that has to be out there.
Yeah.
It has to be out there. Well, I think that's really fascinating and profound because I love science. I'm like a huge fan of science. And I always feel like, you know, they do a roundup in my favorite science magazine at the end of the year. The December issue was always like top stories of whatever year it was. And for me, sure, yes, maybe they've discovered something. Maybe something's been quote unquote illuminated, but there's always like 10,000 more questions you can ask, right? Because right. you find out something, but there's always a longer journey and path to follow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And so many times, how many times have we discovered something in science that 50 years later we were like, well, that was dumb and wrong?
I don't think I have enough fingers and toes. It's like, it's too many.
You need at least 9 more fingers.
Yes. At least. Well, I wanted to ask you, when did you start thinking about writing this series of books that just came out?
I would say a little bit before COVID, so 2019. I basically had this concept based in my dissertation, and I was trying to figure out how to apply that fictionally. And so it was just kind of cooking in the back burner. I was actually working on my dissertation, and eventually I just kind of switched over to the back burner and wrote the novel.
Am I allowed to ask about the concept?
Yeah. The idea of death as being something that is socially determined. And so death is something that has physical and biological aspects to it, but a lot of the meaning we ascribe to death and who we deem worthy of saying that person died and acknowledging a death, these are all social constructs. When we decide when a person is dead, whether we decide they're worthy of remembering, whose deaths we're gonna decide are worth mentioning publicly and noting publicly and discussing, whose lives are worth protecting, and how whose deaths are worth acknowledging is related to the idea of whose lives are worth protecting and investing in, was basically the concept. And it ended up in a snarky, dark fantasy realm with modernized Grim Reapers.
I love that. And I think what you're saying is so apropos to the conversation that's been going on around healthcare in the US and, you know, organizations deciding whether people get care or not, whether they're going to pay for the care that they need or not, you know, and sometimes withholding that care, actually killing someone and causing their death. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's actually absolutely fascinating, very topical. I mean, it's not like this stuff with the insurance companies has just started going on. It's been going on for years, but it's now kind of this discussion has become more on the forefront of society and what have you. And I think, you know, just putting that aside for a second, death is such a mystery. It's such a conundrum for us. You know, you have the people who have near-death experiences, right? So many. They write books about them. They write about their experiences. And the scientists say, oh, no, that was all like just made up in your brain because it's a kind of an explosion of neurons when you're dying, your last oxygen. And by the way, none of that is real. So you have those people. And then you have other people who, nurses and caregivers who are with people before they die, sometimes for months, who talk about inexplicable things happening in the room. And everybody's like, oh, you know, the rationalists or whatever, scientists. Oh, no, you're making that up. It's just the person like hallucinating. It's not real. But then you have people who are, you know, I mean, I've met many people who are psychic and they've told me things that they couldn't possibly know. And they say things and explain things. And I'm like, oh my gosh, there's more to this than we actually understand. And I think the one thing about death that is absolutely true is that people are terrified of it and running away from it as fast as they can. And I'm not saying, you know, we should all be happy and excited about our deaths, that we should strive to go towards death, but I think we should maybe find some way to make peace with it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And there's just so many issues around like neglect, going back to insurance companies and especially like elder abuse and elder neglect, because people just recoil from anyone who's dying. And if you're not willing to sit with discomfort around an issue, then you're not going to be able to notice, let alone fix, any kind of injustices happening around it. But there are those weirdos out there who think about death a lot intentionally.
Well, if you're, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me is if you think about death and how other earlier civilizations oriented themselves towards that subject, mm-hmm. death was a god. Death was mm-hmm. not something to be afraid of. Death was not something to lament. It was something to, like, you understood that it was part and parcel of being born, that it was the final journey that we all take. And it's not something to rail against or fight against, because it really comes in as kind of this pacifier, this mother, this God with a lot of love to take you on your next adventure. I don't know if have you ever studied anything like that?
Yeah, I have, and it's kind of, as you started talking, it made me think about a childhood experience randomly. But like the idea of the psychopomp kind of is something I've always been obsessed with, the sort of some sort of spiritual being that guides you through the death process. Like Hermes is the classic ancient Greek psychopomp. People usually think it's someone else, but it's not. It's Hermes, which is the god of communication and travel, because it is a journey of life, and it's the god who's in charge of helping you communicate with the living is the same dude who's helping you go on into the afterlife. And so I've always loved psychopomps. Like the Grim Reaper is probably the most commonly recognized in America psychopomp. And I was trying to figure out why I'm so obsessed with psychopomps. And Carl Jung would be so happy that it goes back to my childhood.
Would you care to share that story?
I think I have to, because it's ridiculous. And I know that. And why I started thinking about it is because you were talking about the rationalists who hear people describe their personal experiences and they say, no, that did not happen. And I know someone's going to hear this and go, no, that did not happen. But I was a child at one point, believe it or not. I must have been 7, 8 thereabouts. And every summer we had this little fair at the elementary school. And one of the things was you could throw a ping pong ball into a goldfish bowl and you win a goldfish. And so I crushed it, won a goldfish. They were nice enough to not make the goldfish suffer in the bowls. So you got a coupon to go to the pet store and pick one out. And I picked one out. He was yellow. His name was Sausage. He was that long. I wasn't great at names at the time. Sausage was the best I could come up with. And then I won a second goldfish, and I went and I saw this fish, and she was almost completely translucent, and she had these really beautiful flowing white fins. And I got her, and the poor teenager was in there like getting his entire white body just soaking wet, because I kept going, nope, not that one, that one, nope, that one, nope, nope, that one. And I took her home, and I did not name her after a foodstuff. I named her Angel. And then there were several more goldfish who joined, because I ended up getting this 10-gallon tank in my room. And I had a little Japanese pagoda in the middle that was open. And so it was like this big square on the bottom, and so the fish could actually swim in and hang out. And Sausage, the patriarch of the fish tank, one day I went in there and I saw that Sausage was lying on the bottom of the pagoda, and Angel was just like right up next to him, lying on the ground at the pagoda next to him. And I was like, well, that's weird. And then the next morning, Sausage was dead. And I was like, oh no. So I held a very elaborate funeral for Sausage, because I do that for all of my animals. And then like months later, Oreo, there was a trend. Angel broke the trend. She was the only one. Oreo got like impaled on a plastic plant. Like he like bit into it, and I guess it messed him up and he got injured, but he didn't die right away. And then I saw him, he was on the bottom of the pagoda with Angel, and she was just staying with him. And then he died. And every single fish that died before Angel, the same thing happened. She would just be lying on the bottom of the pagoda with them. And then eventually there was just Angel, and she was lying on the bottom of the pagoda by herself. And so I just stayed with her until she died. and it broke my heart. So I think that's why I'm obsessed with Psycho Pomps, because I had one as a pet goldfish as a child, and it pretty much just completely colored the trajectory of my experience in a way I didn't realize until you started talking about death on a podcast.
Okay, I'm
this is so much cheaper than therapy too.
I am like tearing up over here. Partially I'm tearing up because I'm tearing up because more often than not, we look at a goldfish and think it's a stupid, dumb, doesn't have an interior life, doesn't experience emotion, isn't capable of connection. You know, a lot of people would look at that goldfish or even a cat or a dog or anything alive, a grasshopper, and say, that thing, because that's what they're saying, does not have an interior life. It doesn't feel, it doesn't have emotions, it doesn't think. It's not like us, which then, you know, makes it easier to kill and dispose of. But this story that you're telling tells me that there's something more going on, and that the inner lives of goldfish are deeper. There's a deeper well there that I don't think we're really appreciating. I do have to say that my experience with Psycho Pomps, let me tell you, was reading Stephen King's book, Where the Crows, do you know what I'm talking about? They made it into a movie, and it was about an author who goes out into the middle of nowhere to write this book. And he's, well, it's a small village, but he lives on the outside of it. And he kind of sort of semi starts noticing this car, kind of this old muscle car that looks, you know, makes that horrible muffler sound and what have you. And he notices it in like different places in town. And then he notices it like driving right by his house really slowly. And the license plate says high toned son of a bitch or something, like something says that. So he's like, something's amiss, like something's awry. And then all these crows start coming, right? Hanging around the house, and they're not friendly. They like sort of semi start coming after him. And Stephen King lets you know that they're the psychopomps of death, and they're here to take this man. And the man kind of knows it. And he's like, who's in the car? Who's, you know, controlling these crows? What is going on? And then you find out later, I don't want to ruin this for you, but it was his parasitic twin who he like mostly consumed in utero, but still was like partially in his body. I'm sorry, listeners, because I know this is gross. I'm bringing it up and it's totally disgusting, but it's like the twin gets these supernatural powers and is like,
sure.
Oh, you know, you took my life away from me. I've got the power now to take life away from you. So psychopomps, frankly, my entire life have scared the living crap out of me.
Yeah, we had very different experiences.
True story. Yes. Although now I can look at a murder of crows and not say, my God, are they following me? And did I have a parasitic twin? So thank God for that.
I'm glad. I love that for you.
Well, you know, my second question for everybody is, did you grow up in a religious household? And I'm just so curious, you know, if you did, you know, how it evolved over time and how it kind of informed the way that you see the world now.
I did not grow up in a religious household at all. The only time I ever went to church as a kid was if I was having a sleepover at a friend's house and their family went to church, which wasn't very often. It was like maybe twice. I mean, we celebrated Christmas and Easter, mostly in like a present and candy sort of way. So my parents were both raised Catholic, but they didn't keep up with that until I was an adult, and then they went back. But when I was actually being parented, there was no religion, really. And I definitely had this deep need for something, not necessarily religion, but for meaningfulness. And so I was always super, super obsessed with mythology, and especially Greek mythology. And on occasion, I did attempt to found a religion. I think in the sixth grade, so I must have been 11, I wrote a religious text for this religion that I invented called The Way, And it was all very nature focused. And then I learned about Taoism and I was so heartbroken. I was like, oh man, they already did it. China came up with everything before I did. I was so mad.
Yes, including...
They did a better job than I did, honestly. Mine was like 13 pages long. It wasn't that great.
I know, but don't you like look back on your sixth grade self and think, my God, was I precocious?
That's a very generous way of phrasing that. Yeah. I precociously invented a few religions.
Well, and you wrote 13 pages. Like, that sounds like the kind of cult I'd want to join, just to let you know.
Thank you.
Well, that's
goldfish worship. We learn lessons from the goldfish.
Yes. Yeah. I would join that group and I would tithe every week. Nice. First of all, you're the first guest to say that came up with their own religion, but it's such
really?
Oh yes. Oh my God. Yes. What kind of show do you think this is?
I don't know. I just didn't realize how weird of a kid I was. I mean, I guess I did, but.
Well, so. I don't think weird is the word I would use. I would use imaginative. I would use precocious. I would use you definitely were observing the world and kind of trying to figure out, mull over in your mind, what works, what doesn't. How can we find a way to peace? How can we find a way to belonging? How can we find a way to community or connection with that energy? I mean, and it sounds like me from this one religion you created, the way you intuited that God was in nature. Is that true?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And did you have gods and goddesses in your religion?
No, I didn't get that far before I learned about Taoism and then I got disenchanted.
Well, I mean, I think, yes, it's all well and good to give up on something like that. But mm-hmm. I myself would have read your treatise or your explication and reveled in it. And I don't know. I think it's kind of fun to create gods and goddesses, right?
Oh, for sure.
Because there could be like the god of lost objects or the god mm-hmm. of who steals the socks, one from mm-hmm. every pair. Like, who's that god?
It's very Terry Pratchett sort of observation to have.
I know. Yes. So I really am, I guess, a little, you could say, gobsmacked still that you did that. I'm like, what was I doing in sixth grade? I think I was trying to survive.
Reading Anne of Green Gables.
Yes, and reading Anne of Green Gables. But I also think it speaks to great, in you know, life of the mind that you have. So how did you come to study philosophy or how did that bug kind of bite you?
Philosophy bug bit me accidentally. I started off in art history and Japanese studies. I did a double bachelor's in that. And then I went into comparative literature because I was really interested in art history. And in my senior year, we got more into like art theory and critical theory, which was much more interesting to me than just memorizing a bunch of titles of paintings and the names of the artists and looking at trends and actually starting to ask the question of like, what larger thing is happening here culturally? And so I went to a master's in comparative literature, which was a lot of critical theory and psychoanalysis. But then the question became like, well, what even is beauty? What does that even mean? And so then I went into philosophy. And then I was doing all of this philosophy and I was like, in my dissertation on death and the meaning of death socially and what death even is, and does death even exist in nature, or is it just something that exists in relationship? And then I was like, you know what? I could do this so much better as just a novel. And so then I jumped ship from PhD to just writing novels. And so I don't know where I'm going next.
I do want to say that I love that question. What is beauty? Right? Because for different people, different things are beautiful. And I think that, you know, there's subjective beauty, right? So for different people, different things are beautiful, but there's objective beauty. And wasn't it John Keats who wrote Beauty is Truth and Truth Beauty, I think, in one of his poems? I've been reflecting on that lately because I was thinking about the, you know, oh my God, what is going on in America and how truth doesn't seem to exist anymore. And so I've been thinking, does that mean beauty doesn't exist? Because for Keats, those two were inextricably linked. And then the question becomes, well, where has the beauty gone? Is it just hiding? Is it somewhere else? Is it evolving? Is it becoming something else? I don't know. That I think about these things and then I'm like, why can't I sleep at night? So anyway.
You haven't discovered Benadryl yet.
Right, obviously. Right. But objective beauty. I mean, I think a lot of people can agree that sunsets are beautiful. And I think for a lot of people, kindness is beautiful. You know, lifting someone else up is beautiful. Saving the rainforest is beautiful. I think most people could agree on those things. But that question of beauty, it is so profound because we could go back, right, to what those earlier civilizations were positing or suggesting in that death is beautiful. And a lot of people wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah, it's definitely an experience of profound meaningfulness that I think is pretty unparalleled because, and I mean, you could say it's paralleled by birth, like witnessing a birth or giving birth or something like that. But to me personally, I would argue death is more profound just because nobody remembers being born ever, you know? And even if you're with someone as they're being born, they're not going to remember it. But if you're with someone when they die, then that's just, that literally becomes the entire world to them, you know, and it becomes that meaningful to you too. And you will die. That's a fact. You were already born, but you're all going to die still. And so I think that just connects you to others and your own existence in a way that thinking about birth doesn't. And so you could call that beautiful in moments, I would say. Definitely meaningful if you let yourself sit with it. Like my grandmother died at 97, a little under 1 year ago. And I'm the one that people know as the person they can call to ask ultra specific questions about like New York State funerary law or just more general questions like, I've been thinking about death. Is that okay? Can we talk about it? And like, yeah, dog, that's what I'm here for. Because people are nervous to talk about that sort of thing and they're really self-conscious. Like they're almost ashamed to be thinking about it at all because they think it's morbid or something. But so I was just there with my grandmother and it was fine. I was happy to be there to support her. And that was important to me that I was able to do that. I had a younger cousin and she was there. And after she died, she came again and she was so hesitant, but she was like, is it okay if I go in and see her, like see the body? I'm like, yeah, of course it is. Of course you can. Take your time, say goodbye, do whatever you need to do. And she's just like, I just feel really bad because like it's, I kind of want to say fascinating to me. And I'm like, it's literally one of the most fascinating things you can possibly encounter. The fact that we exist and then we don't. Like, what's not fascinating about that? Go nuts, kid. I mean, don't go nuts. I don't know what you're doing in there, but you know, but yeah, people are like ashamed and embarrassed and they think that there's something like pathologically wrong with them if they're interested in the idea of death or if they want to be near the remains of their dead loved one instead of having them immediately whisked away by the funeral director or whoever is showing up.
It's actually really fascinating. I think it's that confrontation, right? When you walk in that room, you're like, this is going to happen to me too. And a lot of people turn away from that. Rightfully so, you know, I mean, just, it's okay. No judgment. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Cause it's, again, it's the shadow, it's the darkness, it's the mystery and it's terrifying.
You can't sit with that all the time.
Right.
Like you need to protect your ego to some extent to stay like a functioning human being.
I think being a functioning human being is overrated, but that's another conversation. Well, I would love to ask you the central question of the podcast. You can tell however many stories you want. It doesn't just have to be one. It can be several.
I always really wanted to. And I was always super desperate to especially when I was younger, defining younger as under 20, and never really did, because I was always thinking of it in a very stereotypically overt sense, like witnessing something physically impossible as we presently understand physics or something like that. But now that I'm not that old, but older, I've become somewhat less misanthropic. And so I'm less desperate to see miracles and magic as something otherworldly, meaning as something separate from this world that I'm in with all these people that I'm stuck with. And now I tend to think of it as like, have you read Watchmen, the graphic novel by Alan Moore? So Dr. Manhattan becomes this superhuman, for listeners who haven't read Watchmen, and he becomes really misanthropic and frustrated with humanity because they just seem to be like willfully destroying themselves and destroying each other, and they could just not, but they keep doing it anyway. And so he's just like, what's the point? I'm just going to go hang out on Mars and like make some cool clocks or whatever with my mind bullets or whatever he does. And but he does also have this human attachment to this woman, and he's looking at her as she's begging him to come and use his like superhuman god powers to come save the planet, and he wasn't going to do it. And then he realizes that, I don't remember the exact quote, but basically he says something like he'd been longing to witness some kind of miracle, like I think he calls it a thermodynamic miracle, where there's an event that is so incredibly improbable that it's effectively impossible, like oxygen turning into gold. And he's saying, you are the product of all of these incredibly improbable things happening. Like that you were born at all is this incredibly improbable event, and that I met you, and that your parents had the relationship that they did, and that their parents had the relationship that they did, that they were in this place where they met this other person, that their life stories all culminated in this way, and the intersecting lines of stories all coalesced into this single person being here right now is itself a kind of miracle. And so now for me, I tend to think of my experience of the miraculous as being like meeting the exact person I needed to meet at the exact right time, when it was just so improbable. But in that moment of my life, I'm just like, you are exactly the person I needed right now. And the fact that you even exist itself is so improbable and so miraculous, but that I happened to find you when I needed you the most, when I'm like this because of all the stuff that's happened before me. It's just, to me, that's become incredibly miraculous, which is kind of a banal answer. I don't see dead people. I'm sorry. I want to. I bet they're chill.
There's still time.
There's still time. Thank you. I mean, that thing with a goldfish, I would say, is pretty miraculous.
Oh my goodness. Yes. And to have seen it at, I mean, I don't know anyone else who's ever described an event like that, but what an incredible gift to you to be able to witness something so profound and witness the care that Angel had just being.
And because I found that fish in that tank, because I won that game in that little fair at that elementary school where that fish happened to be. And that's pretty wonderful.
Oh yeah. And what I really understand you to say is that we have these miraculous things happen, right? Like you saying mm-hmm. this encounter with this person, right? That came right at the time that you needed them. But that event was actually the result of a cascade of other events, of tiny happenings, mm-hmm. of occurrences, of other encounters to get you in the right place at the right time so that you could meet someone who is going to potentially change your life. And that, how do we explain that?
I don't feel the need to.
Is there a
philosophy? I kind of like reveling in the miracle.
Yeah, reveling in the miracle. Is there a philosophy that talks about, I don't know, the cascade of events and how these seemingly small things can shape our lives irrevocably or lead to something that shapes our lives irrevocably?
I don't know. I think that would mostly be like a question for physics, more so than philosophy. The philosophers would be asking, so then what about it?
Right. Okay.
Like maybe one of the ethical implications of that. Maybe we should all just stay home and not do anything ever. Lest we like scare a fly that flaps its wings and then causes a hurricane and somewhere or something.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Laying in bed for an extended period of time does sound good, but it probably get boring after a while.
It's the ethically responsible thing for you to do. So
right.
I'll write you a doctor's note, a very specific sort of doctor's note from a philosopher. Okay,
perfect. Okay. You are amazing and a gem. Kind sir. Thank you. But you're saying physics because of just the quantum world. And first of all, how mysterious it is. And that, you know, spooky action at a distance where two particles go off in opposite directions, but change one, you know, presumably 10 light years away from the other one. The other one changes at the exact same moment. So we're actually in this reality, and physicists are trying to figure out what's going on. Scientists are trying to figure out what's going on, because what is reality truly when there are all these profound, crazy things that we can't explain? I was reading a thing in a book or a treatise or something. Anyway, a magazine article, and they were saying that they still don't know what gravity is. I mean, they know that it's caused by mass. An object comes in, it has mass, it creates gravity, which then the gravity affects other things around it and what have you. But at the heart of it, they're still trying to figure out gravity. And I thought, what? And so that's what's exciting is there's still so much mystery and so much that we don't know.
To me, I think when I think of miracles, I think of the fact that anything exists at all is miraculous. And the way everything exists and how everything happens is miraculous. But the experience of a miracle is just something that happens where the miraculousness that's inherent in everything all the time just is illuminated. So to me, that's what a miracle is, I think.
Yeah.
Glad we could work that out.
Yeah, I'm glad we could work it out too. Thank you. I'm just going to give me 5 minutes so I can call all the news channels so we can tell the world.
Guys, we fixed it. We figured it out.
We fixed it. And it
page 14 of my religious treatise. We just wrote it.
Oh my God. You can bring it back and continue. Because now you know.
Now I know.
And with that, Happy New Year. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Elijah, who is not only an incredible goldfish parent and an incredible teller of dad jokes, but is also a novelist. His first book was recently released in the Hereafter Lies series that I do believe he said is going to include 9 books. To find out a little more about Elijah and the incredible work that he's doing, the creations that he's coming out with, well, click on the link in the episode show notes. His website is seriously fun, as is Elijah. Now, as we move forward into this year, I want each and every one of you to know that I believe in you, and I believe in our collective goodness, our collective kindness, our collective just spreading the love around, and that we can achieve beautiful things. Never forget that, because it is, in the end, all up to us, isn't it? Each and every one of us is going to bring our own particular brand of beauty into the world, whether it includes shadows or not. You know, I err on the side of shadows because I've always liked and appreciated dim lighting. I've always liked and appreciated shadows and the shapes they create in the world. But just remember that we can do good things and that we can shape the world. Happy New Year, everyone. And thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Elijah. Tell dad jokes. Be funny. Be shameless. Be sweet. Revel in your own hilarity. Elijah is so funny and so wonderful with just being unapologetic with the jokes and puns he shares. And you know what? They make everyone around him laugh. They bring everyone else's spirits up. So be like Elijah. Tell good jokes, tell bad jokes, tell jokes that are maybe make people wonder if you're actually all that funny. But do it unapologetically. Be yourself. And I do think that this world needs more dad jokes, more bad jokes, because we all need to laugh a little more. We all need to chuckle a little more. And inside that laughter, inside that chuckling, inside that hilarity, there's strength there. And from that strength, we can foster a belief that we can change the world. Can I talk to you just a little bit about how my dream is to go to Japan for like 3 to 6 months somehow?
That's very specific.
Well, I want to do some forest bathing and I want to look at beauty. And I love the outdoors and nature. And I've just been doing some reading and it seems like there's a lot of beauty over there. And I really just want to go and like soak it in.
It's a really special place. And the forests are incredibly beautiful. I was very lucky that I got to spend as much time over there as I did. And I went on a trip. I don't even remember what temple it was because I was 20. And who even remembers being 20 anymore? But some Shinto temple in Kyoto. And, or was it Himeji? It might have been Himeji. But it was during the autumn and the mountains were completely covered in Japanese maple leaves. And they were all just so red. Just completely red because we have maples here. They're not the same kind of maples.
Okay.
They're like these almost more spidery leaves and they turn this incredibly rich vermilion color that is just, it feels a bit like you've dropped acid when you're looking at it because it doesn't seem like colors should be able to be that bright and be natural and not artificial. And it's almost disconcerting, but it was so stunning.
Lucky. Okay. Hello.
Very lucky. Yeah.
I would think that is both subjectively and objectively beautiful. I mean, you can fight me on it. You can fight me on it. But I also think the science around that goes on around trees and an ecosystem around the scents that the trees are releasing and how humans have certain receptors that are specifically designed to take those basically kind of pheromones in, which then cause, yes, which cause pleasure or relaxation. I mean, it just completely makes everything calm down in your body. It helps regulate everything. And I just thought to myself, well, of course we co-evolved with trees and forests. And so our bodies, you know, stressful fight or flight all the time while hominids were evolving. But in the forests, you know, we found a way to utilize these smells that the trees gave off to kind of help us calm down. And I just think there's something really beautiful about that. And of course the trees and plants are using our, you know, we breathe in oxygen, the trees, you know, we breathe out. Oh my God. I'm so tired right now.
Carbon dioxide.
Thank you. We breathe out carbon dioxide and the trees love it. And so there's something really beautiful about that reciprocal relationship. Mm-hmm. So yes, Japan is on my radar.
For the trees specifically, for the trees. Which honestly, fair, totally support. I mean, maybe get some ramen while you're there, but mostly the trees. Yeah.
Yes. Ramen and trees. Why not?
Ramen and trees. That sounds like, oh my God, that's just like a new dream that I'm never going to have is open up a teeny tiny little ramen cart in the middle of the forest and just like go around and pull it and have like a little bell maybe. And people are just in the forest. In the middle of nowhere, and then they hear a little bell. They're like, what is that? And it's just some American dude with some okay ramen. Like, it's fine. It's not going to be one of those secret hole-in-the-wall Michelin star ramen places that you'll find in Japan, but it's okay.
Don't be scared, children. It's just the ramen man.